Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
And I'm Joan Crawford. We have to talk about Feud.
I'm glad Joan Crawford is here. Thanks so much for coming.
Did you watch Feud?
I didn't.
It just ended on Sunday.
Are they going to do... Okay, wait,
sessions.
Hold on. We're not done with the intro.
All right, sorry. Let's go. Finish the intro.
Okay. Today, Frank and I are just going to talk to you. I'm actually Gwen, by the way. I'm not Frank or Joan Crawford. And next week, we are going to have an interview with Corey from Storytime Underground, which is a really cool organization that helps children librarians be activists and do better story times and sort of live their lives better out in the story time trenches.
I hope everyone's liking the weekly format.
Yes, we got some really nice feedback. Thank you, everybody who fed back.
I have to respond to some comments because someone exhorted me to give Harry Potter another chance.
Yes. Well, Bayana and Robin from last week are going to come back and have monthly check-ins with you to see how much progress you've made.
Oh, God. I don't need any more pressure.
I think it's almost time for us to do another challenge episode.
Somebody mentioned that in one of the podcasts, they liked that we did that, that we suggested books that we didn't think the
And we're going to do it seven times, and I'm just going to challenge you to read Harry Potter books each time. Oh, yeah, that's true.
We could do a summer challenge.
It's our official summer challenge.
We'll have to think about that. That's fun, actually.
It was really fun. We're going to do it again. Get ready for, what's the second Harry Potter? Chamber of Secrets?
That'll actually... Maybe I should, because that'll give me a good excuse just to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you said it gets better. The first one's a lot of exposition, and you forgot how much it was.
That's true.
And then I guess I know my challenge.
My favorite one is 4, actually, which is Goblet of Fire, which is this like tournament that they have. I think that 4...
Can you jump? You can't jump.
You could, but I wouldn't.
It's against the canon.
Yeah. Maybe we can combine them. You can do 2 and 3. And then you can give me some other brick of a biography to read.
Yeah. anyway, Joan Crawford.
Feud. So aren't they going to do multiple seasons with other feuders?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think Ryan Murphy, the producer, his concept is the concept of feud, and each season is a different feud. Mm-hmm. So next time, I think, is Charles and Diana.
Oh.
Next season.
That's interesting.
And this one was Bette Davis and Joan Crawford.
How do you watch Feud? Is it on Netflix?
FX?
Oh, FX. Is it on Hulu, maybe? I hope it's
God
on Hulu.
God knows. Probably somewhere in the Ethernet, internet, in the ether. But anyway, it ended, and it was, Jessica Lange as Joan Crawford, Susan Sarandon as Bette Davis, and it was pretty stellar. Mm-hmm. And it was sad. Like, the ending, the last... episode really was sad, really, about Joan Crawford. Like, she has such a reputation and she's such a personality, and God knows, I don't think it would be easy to be around her.
Yeah.
She's like, we just talked about the books we challenged each other. Like, last year you gave me Harry Potter and I gave you a biography of Ava Gardner, Hollywood thing. And Joan Crawford so came from a poor background and bought into this whole Hollywood thing, which you can't fully buy into. Because it's so based on superficiality and your worth at the time, and you're really an object in some ways to make money. And then when her time had passed, getting older, I mean, the show dealt a lot with actresses getting older, she felt betrayed, and like crazily betrayed, like personally betrayed.
Yeah.
And so that could manifest in lots and lots of aggression and lots of, counter betrayals and counter attacks. But ultimately, it was just sad. Like, she just had nothing else. I mean, there's a line, could be considered trite, but it's very universal. Like, she's like, I don't know who I am when I'm alone. I mean, that's sort of a sad thing. And I remember thinking, she should have read more. She probably should have, actually.
Yeah.
It would have given her some sort of solace. Anyway.
She should have gotten a dog, like Ava Gardner.
She did get a dog
at
the very end.
Yeah.
That's actually a good point, because like, when the dog comes in late and you realize, she must really be lonely because she's getting a dog. I mean, not that, you could have a dog at any age, but you could see that it was an attempt to fill something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
I got a dog when I was lonely, when I was working from home. In my previous job, and my husband was making fun of me because I used to call this squirrel that visited our back deck my coworker. And I would be like, I saw my colleague today, my coworker, the squirrel. He was like, yeah, it's time to get that dog we've been talking about.
So you were that isolated.
I was that isolated. Oh. It was bad. That was a dark
time. People who need people.
People Speaking who need dogs. Speaking
of which, Barbara Streisand's birthday was Monday. God, like holding out all the icons.
Happy birthday, Barbara Streisand. She was
75. She's 75. I can't believe that.
She's 75?
Yes. I can't believe there might be a world one day
She's
without
looking
her.
Good for 75. My God.
My mother loved her. I always bring up my mother these days. She's like a thing.
Aw.
Anyway, so, yeah.
Has Barbara Streisand ever written a book?
She did a book on design, my passion for design.
Really?
Because she loves fabric and color.
Okay.
And
she's never written an autobiography.
You haven't heard about it? She has this incredible basement in her Malibu mansion that's basically a tricked out mall of all her objects she's collected over the years. Like, it's literally storefronts and a street in her cellar that she visits in her private home. It's not like open to the public or anything. It's like for her own enjoyment and her friends, I guess. And it made such an impact because it was in this book, My Passion for Design, that some guy wrote a play about it, like a one-man
show.
Set
in the mall?
I didn't see the play, but it sounds hilarious. It sounds really good.
Wow.
It's called Buyer and Seller. Michael Urie, I think, wrote it from Ugly Betty.
Oh.
So anyway, yeah, she has. How did we get in this subject?
I don't know. But she's never written an autobiography, huh?
No.
Oh, do you think she's going to?
Maybe.
I think it's time, Barbara. If you're listening, I think it's time. I would read that, and I never read stuff about famous people.
I wonder how honest she'd be. I wonder how honest anyone is, really. How honest you can be.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about that before we got on the air, about, like, that line between, you know, what you feel like you should present and what you're comfortable with presenting versus what really is happening, what really is true. And even if you can figure out what the truth is about yourself, I mean, we always say, we all have delusions about ourselves that we might not even know. We're espousing a party line about ourselves that's not really that true.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, if anything, the core of everything I talk about is always really somewhat about that. Like, how am I lying to myself?
That raises really good questions about actual biographers too, about people who are writing about other people. How can you even hope to capture what their real story is? Yeah. Which brings me to, did you notice that?
Set up.
The book that I wanted to talk about this week, which is called Undefeated, by Steve Shenkin, who is sort of the master of YA and children's nonfiction. He has every award in the book. He's been nominated for the National Book Award. But this particular book is about Jim Thorpe. And Jim Thorpe...
Isn't he called the All-American?
Is he called the All-American?
He's a
I don't
football
know.
Player.
He is, and he was also a track and field star.
Okay.
And he's also Native American. And he also went to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School and played on the football team there. So this biography is really pretty brilliant because Steve Shenkin, I think, is really good at writing biographies, and he also writes historical historical narrative nonfiction. The way that he is tying this man's life into the history sort of Native Americans at this time in the country's history is amazing. So like it's in the late It goes sort of from the late 1870s to like the early part of the 20th century. And this school so he's doing a good job of like weaving both strands of this sort of football story about Jim Thorpe together with the school itself. And I should give a disclaimer. I'm only about a third of the way through this book, but it is so interesting so far because it's really giving the history of this school and of football generally, as well as Jim Thorpe himself. And I think this book would be great for a reluctant reader, like a teen, I hesitate to say teen boy, any teen who is into sports and not super into reading. I think this book would be a great hook. It's written really well. It has really cool pictures. The chapters are super short. And it also, I think any adult who's interested in learning about this period of time would also be into it. And I think there's even a big format switch up toward the end as I'm paging through it, but I don't know
what
that for sure.
Format switch.
It looks like it gets divided up into different sporting events that he did because he also was an Olympic gold medalist. And I think it gets divided up into different phases of his career toward the end.
Whereas the beginning is like this biography of his background.
Yeah,
is it cataloged as biography?
It's YA nonfiction.
Yeah.
But it does not have a B. We're looking at the at the sports. Label now.
It's in sports. So it focuses.
Oh, is it in sports?
796 is sports.
Look at Frank know the Dewey Decimal System off the top of his head. I do not know
this.
That
podcast is over.
I'm revealed as the fraud that I really am. Fraud. I don't know that many Dewey numbers off the top of my head anymore.
We could be the third season. Yeah. Gwen and Frank feud.
So the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, I'm going to get it wrong every time, is so crazy. Do you know about this at all? So this was really close to where I grew up in Pennsylvania. So it was founded in 1879 by this captain from the U.S. Army named Richard Henry Pratt. And the complexity of this is really incredible because he had served in the Army. He had had all kinds of contact with Native peoples. And this is at the time when, like, the shameful period of American history where essentially white people were out to steal and ruin everything about Native Americans' lives, right? They forced them onto reservations. They then stole land from the reservations in the great, you know, land rush in the 1870s and 1880s. And basically what this army captain did was he went to the tribe leaders and said, your lives are being ruined by these white people, and we see it, and us is what he was saying. And if you don't educate your children differently and basically turn your children into white people, this is going to keep happening, and bad things are going to continue for you. You're going to keep signing treaties. If you don't learn how to read and write the white man's language, then you're not going to be able to survive in this country. And so under this guise of helping them, and the reason it's complex is that this man, by all accounts, did think that he was helping and was trying to help. But what he did was ruin their lives completely because he said, your culture is not valuable and it's not going to stay in this world. And you need to send all of your children away to this boarding school that I am founding in this old army barracks in Pennsylvania. And you have to send your kids east and bring them to me. And I'm going to turn them into white people. And it was said, you know, completely explicitly like that, like the motto of the school. I didn't write the motto of the school down, but it was something like destroy everything that isn't white about you. That's a terrible summary of it, but whatever. Wow. That was the basic concept. And so they took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids. 10,000 kids eventually went to this school. And by one account, only like 158 graduated from the school because the kids would run away and the kids would drop out of school. And a lot of the kids died in the school because they hadn't been exposed to these white people's diseases, which then ran rampant through the school. But they were forced, the stuff that these kids were forced to do is so upsetting to read about. Because they were forced to change all of their clothes. They had to give up their names. They actually, Steve Schenken tells an incredible story about how when this class was taken in, they couldn't read or write. A lot of them were quite young. They were as young as 6 who went to this school and as old as 25. And they were taken into this room and shown a blackboard with, like, quote unquote, good names on it, like biblical white people names, and forced to choose a name, like to just point to them, but they couldn't read or write. So they didn't know what they were pointing to. And so can you imagine what that would feel like to just be like, well, your name's not your name. They were punished for everything. They were punished for speaking their own languages. They were punished for wearing their old clothes. Like, they were all forced to wear this like horrible, itchy underwear, these like red, like long johns.
Is this
suits.
In the book?
Yeah, this is all in the book.
Wow.
And it's presented in this very clear and sort of simple way that is obviously designed to kind of like move the pace along, but it's brutal. Like, it's a really interesting, incredible read. You hit
on a lot before when you said complex. Like, you said it's complex, but, and then you went on to talk about what you just talked about very powerfully.
Yeah.
It's something I was thinking about too on the way here about human behavior is very complex. His intentions, you could say, were good. His belief in what he was doing was he felt for the better to help them get into this. It's a complex issue, but, like, as we know, politics and machinations of power can't be complex. It seems to not be able to acknowledge complexity and say, this is wrong, this is right. It almost makes me, like, think that somewhere along the line, politics, whatever that entity of politicians and politics, just assumed people are too stupid to accept complexity and to say, yes, you have a culture. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have this this varied culture, but yes, you need this skill possibly to get along in this new world. Like, whether you like it or not, the white people are here taking over. Let's try to get in with that, but not deny. But that complexity is always lost.
The sheer hubris of being like, our way is right, your way is wrong, we're civilized and you're not, we know better and we know best for you, and we're just going to steamroll over everything else that's come before us is so, it's so frustrating to read it from a current perspective and just be like, how could you do this if you were indeed well-intentioned Richard Henry Pratt? Like, how can you just look at that and say there is no value in what they had? Like, it's right.
But that's, I mean, you know what I was thinking of when you were talking? For some reason, I was thinking about the Japanese internment camps of World War II.
Oh, like, that's interesting.
When we went to war with Japan and Germany, it's like Japanese Americans, American citizens were interned in California after Pearl Harbor, like, because they were considered a threat. And it's like, again, a perfect example of not dealing with the complexity of the issue. Like, these are American citizens.
Right.
So have nothing,
or they're American.
No allegiance, just because they are, look Japanese, were of Japanese heritage. It's like, isolate, deal with, push, you know, brutalize. It's, again, not acknowledging the complexity. It seems like it's, maybe we're not evolved enough as human beings to function that way, because it brings in too many variables and people are just want to say, just deal with it.
Yeah.
Just deal with it and try to force them. And when that Pratt guy goes in... Part of that is a hubris, like you said, and not acknowledging that he's as human as they are, and how would he feel? I mean, that sounds so basic, but truly, how would he feel if somebody came in? Maybe you could argue that maybe, not in your example in this book, the Jim Thorpe book, but like, we wouldn't move forward as forward if we didn't sort of just blind eye to human complexity, because it would just maybe stop us, because we would all just say, well, we're just human. I don't know.
Right. Or we're like,
I'd like
paralyzed.
To find.
I do think that this book and other things that I have seen give me a little bit of hope for the future, because I do think that the way that things children now are studying and the way that children learn history does honor that complexity a little bit more. Like, I talked a really long time about that Myra Coleman book, the picture book about Thomas Jefferson, that acknowledges that he owned slaves and had, you know, a lot of really terrible contradictions in his personal life about slavery. And so I think that I hope that history is getting better. It's certainly better than like our parents' generation. And so I wanted to read a little part of this, because this is what I was hoping. And I will say, I also want to acknowledge before I read this, that one of the, I'm reading this for the young adult book committee that I'm on. And one of the members of the committee did acknowledge that, like, it would have been, I would like to read a history of the Carlisle School from the perspective of a Native American writer. Like, I would really love to hear a, like, own voices take on this. However, I do think that this book that Steve Shenkin has written is doing a really good job of presenting this in all of its complexity. And so here, I wanted to read a little part. So this is just him in, you know, the very beginning of the book. We're only 29 pages in. He writes, "Wouldn't it have been possible for young Native Americans to transition to the realities of modern American life without being torn from their parents and their culture? As tough as life was for most immigrants, they could at least live with their families, speak their native language at home, celebrate their religious holidays. Why should Native Americans, the only people on the continent who weren't immigrants, be treated so differently? To put it bluntly, Pratt did not respect Indian culture. He seemed to have genuinely believed he was helping the people, but he began with the bigoted conviction that white American civilization was superior to all others. The rich diversity of Native American cultures and languages, the complex relationships between the nations, the thousands of years worth of knowledge about living in this part of the world, Pratt dismissed it all as savage and worthless." And so that, I'm like, good. Like, I feel like that is the kind of thing that I wish I had read when I was a teenager, and that I'm glad that teens will be reading now. Like, at least it's acknowledging the complexity, saying, here are questions that, you know, need to be posed when you're learning about the history of something like this.
Yeah.
So that's, and then there's also all of this Jim Thorpe stuff. There's like this stuff about the history of football and Pop Warner and sports ball.
Well, I guess you don't know, but like, how did Jim Thorpe's life ultimately turn out?
I do not know yet. I'll let you know when I find out. Yeah. I know he becomes an Olympic gold medalist. And in track and field, having nothing to do with football. But I'll let you know.
I feel like I know his story, but I can't recall it. It was certainly made into a movie at some point.
Yeah.
I thought it was called Jim Thorpe All-American. It was the movie. I don't know.
Maybe.
Anyway.
That's an interesting...
Now I want to know. You can't...
Oh, sorry. I know. I am kind of breaking the rules by like bringing in a book that I haven't finished. But who knows? Maybe the ending is awful and the whole thing falls apart.
Well,
but
I mean, given just what you just said about the school and that he was trained in.
Yeah.
What his emotional life or how he survived. Like, did he have the skills to survive happily or at least somewhat contentedly in life?
I mean, he certainly achieved fame.
Yeah.
In his lifetime.
Well, you know, there's plenty of stories of people achieving fame, then it falls apart.
Very true.
I just talked about that.
Very true. He's the first Native American to win a gold medal for his country.
Interesting.
Another interesting thing in here is that I learned about, and this also, side note, this is why Wikipedia is really cool. Like, I looked up, why'd you just roll your eyes?
Know. Go ahead.
See, librarians, I think, have a reflexive thing about Wikipedia, but the thing that I love about it is the way that it can lead you to primary sources.
Yeah.
So I looked up Carlisle Industrial Indian School online, read the Wikipedia entry, which was really good and really detailed and had a lot of good pictures. And then the footnotes lead you to like the actual sources. And so there is one of the people presented in this book with a lot of quotes actually is somebody named Luther Standing Bear, who eventually became a Lakota chief, and he was one of the people to actually graduate from this Carlisle school. Mm. And a lot of his writing is published online and is really beautiful and incredible, and we'll link to it on the show page. But a lot of his like ruminations from this time period are actually like out there in the public domain, and you can read them.
Did you read them?
I did.
So you did get a firsthand account of what it was like in that school.
Right. And that, I feel like that's what really good nonfiction can do, is that it can sort of, even something that's a summary written for young adults, like this book Undefeated is, it can lead you to the like primary source stuff. And it's that stuff is irreplaceable. It's amazing.
So did he, I guess he became a thinker and a writer, so he survived in some ways to talk about that experience.
Right. And he actually like went back to lead his people also, which was... I haven't read the rest of the book, so I don't know if that was unusual or not, but I think he could also be considered a quote unquote success story.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess it's my time to talk about it. I don't
I guess
feel
it
like
is.
It.
How are you going to tie it in?
Oh, wait. I feel
wait, wait. That's, just, that book is Undefeated by Steve Schenken. I hope I'm saying that right. It's Schenkin.
No, you just, you hit on a lot of really interesting things, and it was inspiring to hear you talk actually about that.
I aim to inspire you, Frank. Every week I try to inspire you.
And you do. I don't know. I have a bunch of things in the ether, but like I might as well bring up someone I've mentioned briefly before, but like a public thinker named Camille Paglia.
You
know she is. And she has a new book out called Free Women, Free Men, Sex, Gender, and Feminism, which is her collected essays over the years. I mean, she became a big... public figure in 1990 when she wrote a book called Sexual Personae, which was a very academic book, came out of her doctoral thesis about art and literature and culture. But it became a big bestseller at the time because her writing is extremely aggressively hothouse. She writes in this fever dream. Like I feel like she puts on headphones and like blasts the Rolling Stones and just writes about culture. I mean, she's sort of like this out there gal. And she's a teacher. So this new book is her essays, and it's collected over the years. But it's funny because a lot of them, like because of the collection, like seems somewhat repetitive and stuff. And there was a review in the New York Times which actually said, which was a positive review of the book and of Camille Paglia, saying that she's a needed thinker in the culture. But it said, like, sometimes reading the book, it was a little repetitive, that it was like being stranded in a bar when the jukebox only has two songs, both by Pat Benatar. So that sort of gives you a little example of Camille Paglia. She's like a rock and roll babe, but a real, you know, rigorous thinker. I wish I could describe her writing better.
She was a music critic.
She criticizes everything, basically. I mean, her biggest, you know,
she writes about
notoriety.
Politics, too.
Politics is feminism, is that she's very she's very vocal about, you know, the second wave feminism of Gloria Steinem and that period against that, which she perceives as like a man-hating feminism. And her thing, Camille Paglia's thing, is very much what we've been talking about that complexity of life as it's lived. And she really goes to art a lot. And, you know, I've thought about this, and I wanted to avoid using the word high-low because I I don't even think she uses it. And I just sort of, it misses the mark, because it's what she would say, something like David Cassidy, you know, a teen idol. Mm-hmm. His obsession with him, like teenage girls and boys obsessed with David Cassidy, is just as valid to think about our obsession with Michelangelo's David statue. Like, the impulses are the same. Like, mm-hmm. the art, the impulse to revere beauty, to feel attracted to charisma, translates from what we call high art to pop culture. Mm-hmm. So she reveres fashion magazines. She certainly revered Madonna. She had a very complicated relationship. You just made a face. See, that's what the complexity is, though. That's a good, that's a really good example.
Revered fashion magazines.
Because, like, right, you could go, and I bet your head, and I understand this, went right to, like, it imposes a false sense of identity for women. It's mm-hmm. an ideal that can't be achieved.
That combined, I mean, models with not come liking out and Gloria say,
I don't even look like this.
Yeah.
And I think Camille Paglia would agree in some ways, but she also says, we're still, and this is what I've said before, but what persists? Fashion magazines still sell. And you could say, well, people are being brainwashed into it, but there's something about them that attracts us. We are attracted to beauty. We are sexual creatures that sort of crave that. How do I be beautiful? How do I get beauty? How do I be a part of that? I mean, it's a powerful force. So, like we just talked, we can't deny the complexity of that emotion, because I do want to think about those things that don't mm-hmm. go away. Mm-hmm. Like, second wave feminism didn't eradicate fashion magazines. I mean, so it's there to think about. And she sort of says it's part of the art culture. It's part of this. She really makes a lot about how art generates, people who generate art are telling a truth about human life, because it's coming from somewhere visceral and coming from somewhere passionate. And that's what makes her very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, she could be very combative and she's very funny. And she certainly is controversial, but I feel like, you know, she's an interesting read, and it's necessary to have interesting people thinking out loud for mm-hmm. you in the culture.
Definitely.
So her book, the new book of collected essays, is Free Women, Free Men, Sex, Gender, and Feminism. She also wrote a book, which I would definitely recommend, on her explication of 43 of the world's best poems. We said we wanted to bring in poetry, mm-hmm. and she takes 43 poems that she's selected, and in a 2 or 3 page summary, discusses these poems in a very visceral, very exciting, passionate way. So it's called Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems.
So wait, it's her, she's explicating the poems?
Yeah, they'll okay. have, like, you know, an Emily Dickinson poem, and then afterwards, for 3 pages, she'll discuss, like, what that poem means. Like, she does close readings, and she riffs on them, and it's really sort of fascinating. I mean, like, she's written a lot about politics. Like, she, you know, I think I've mentioned this before. I've talked about Camille Paglia.
Yeah.
I find
yeah.
her an interesting thinker. So mm-hmm. she...
Are you going to read us a poem?
I don't know. Should I?
Yeah.
It's called Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers by Emily Dickinson. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs and firmaments row. Diadems drop and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. I love Emily Dickinson.
That's neat.
So, I mean, I don't even half understand it, but I've read her a lot, and I read Camille Paglia's discussion of this poem, and it's just like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. Like, this woman is intense. And actually, I might as well just segue into my non-book rec, because...
Go for it.
This is what I was going to do. We just did this in our different order, which is a new movie directed by Terrence Davies and starring Cynthia Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
About Emily Dickinson.
Saw a trailer for this.
Called A Quiet Passion. I have not seen the movie. I think it just came out. Terrence Davies is the director, and I love Terrence Davies. Terrence Davies is a British director who did the movie version of Edith Wharton's House of Mirth with Gillian Anderson, which is like an absolutely fabulous, great movie. Mm. I mean, almost a valid, honest interpretation of Edith Wharton's House of Mirth, but with his artistic imprint.
Uh-huh.
It's so good. And he also did a movie called The Long Day Closes, which is not for everybody because it's very impressionistic. Terrence Davies did this book about his childhood in post-war Britain. And what he captures for me Terrence Davies, is this sense of when you're a child, especially like this quotidian sense of the day being incredibly long or a moment being incredibly long. Like, do you recall like being a child and you could play like literally in a sandbox, scooping sand from one place to another for hours, and you're just lost in your thoughts. Like everything's new. Every sensation is new. Mm. And he has this scene where his character, basically Terrence Davies, a boy, the young boy in post-war Britain, is just swinging on a bar, hanging over a set of stairs in the slum section of London, I believe, or Liverpool, and swinging on it, just like, you know, almost humming to himself. Like, and he could do that for like half an hour, and it seems like an eternity. But what he does was he juxtaposes that with these high shots of all the boys' most sacred places, which is school, church, and going to the movies. And it's this elegiac sort of pan of all these momentous things in a young kid's life. And over it is Debbie Reynolds singing Tammy. And that's an example of what I just said about Camille Polly and what we've been talking about, this high-low thing. It's like, you know, you could be like, Debbie Reynolds. It's like, how cheeseball, like Tammy? It's like, but things like that in popular culture embed themselves in us and are just as meaningful as a revelation you might see seeing a Da Vinci painting. Mm-hmm. And I like that equation, because actually even more so, some people might look back and think of Tammy, the song Tammy by Debbie Reynolds, as like so emotionally profound that, but yet Da Vinci doesn't mean much to them. I mean, I like that elevation of popular culture. Let's say elevation, like as if high art is the highest. You know what I mean, though? Like high, low thing.
Yeah.
So he's juxtaposing boy's life, like his serious daily life, and overlays it with this song, and the combination is just unbelievably beautiful.
Whippoorwill, you and I know. Tammy, Tammy, can't let him go. The breeze from the bayou keeps murmuring. So, when the night is warm, soft and warm, I long for his charms. I'd sing like a violin if...
Yeah, so... So my other book is a book...
Look at you going all out of order.
I know. I feel disorganized. Is... High culture, so to speak, is, you know, Henry James, the author.
Yes.
So Henry James, American, who actually late in life became British citizen, turn of the century, last century author who wrote Portrait of a Lady, The Ambassadors, Bostonians, Washington Square. I've always found him so difficult, so hard to read, and I could never really figure it out. Like, I couldn't get why it was so difficult.
We have a ton of Henry James stuff in our ebook collection, and it often pops up, and I feel like I just see it a lot, and I associate Henry James with like the hardest of hard school reading.
So I put one of his books on our book discussion list, and one of his so-called lesser known books called The Other House, and of course published by my beloved New York Review of Books. I always give them a shout out, because like a book published by them or reprinted by them is just like a recommendation to me.
So it's called The Other House. It's a very nice looking book.
Yeah, it is. They always make beautiful books. Mm-hmm. So I gave it a shot, and I actually finished it, and I actually got through it. And I realized what I was so attracted to was that his language is so difficult that I felt like if I could conquer it, if I could understand it, then I would be a better person, that I would think clearer, that I would... It's like mastering someone else's language, like I always say about Virginia Woolf, like sort of getting into the rhythm of the author who's not so easily accessible, possibly... Mm-hmm. Is very satisfying. But I also realized as I was reading him, what he does is fascinating. Like this book, The Other House, is basically, you could almost say a soap opera. It's like about A loves B, loves C, loves D. It's like, you know, Gwen loves Frank, loves Reichert, loves Tommy. I mean, it's like this classic melodramatic chain of who loves who and how who's going to get together and what's going to happen. Except something terrible happens, actually. But it's that basic premise about like a social high upper class, two families and two different houses separated by a little stream with a little bridge over it, you know, each calling the other house, and how they intermingle and how they play their love lives out. But what Henry James seems to do to me is that his words, his wall of words, is like his incredible use of language, which is like so complicated. It's like almost reading like a language other than your English, is actually this giant wedge, like giant like wall between you, the reader, and emotion. So like
you're encapsulating why this is difficult.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like he works almost very hard to distance as much as possible from the actual emotion. So mm-hmm. when something does pop up in the language, like a passion for someone or a terrible incident happens, it's almost like someone threw water in your face. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like you just were just talking incredibly civilized. Mm-hmm. But he keeps this distance, and it's sort of a fascinating thing. I think that's why I was fascinated with it, because I wanted to crack the code, so to speak. But I think I didn't go back to it often enough because I sensed that lack of emotion. I love emotional accessibility in books.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting to make a kind of weird connection. We were just talking about that with Colson Whitehead, right? That with the Underground Railroad, there is a distance in his writing, and it is not this like total, oh my God, melodramatic, like really emotional book. It's like there's a distance there that sort of keeps you from like feeling like it's a soap opera.
Right.
Which is, yeah.
But I mean, like, James also has his own, Henry James has his own rhythm. Like, he writes sentences that are, like, a paragraph long, mm-hmm. and sometimes you'll, at the beginning of the sentence, he starts talking about something you don't even know, and then at the end of it, he refers back to it, and you figure it out. Like, it's this incredible journey that you have to say, sometimes you get into the rhythm, which I love, mm-hmm. or sometimes you read a half a page, and you're like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Like, you just started, you know, drifting off. Hey, if you want to crack a difficult language, but a propulsive storyline, I would say take a chance on Henry James, The Other House.
Have you had the book club yet where everybody else had to read it?
No, this Thursday.
Oh, interesting.
And believe me, some of the people in the group I've seen in the library looked at me like, why did you do this to me? And I was like, I loved it. I mastered Henry James.
I'll
probably never
you.
Read another one of his. But
I hate you. How could you have done this to
exactly.
me?
Exactly. So I already gave my non-book recommendation, which was the new movie about Emily Dickinson,
yeah.
Quiet Passion. So are we on to yours?
That movie looks really good. I would really like to see that too. So yes, I have one too. I want to recommend The Lenny Letter, which is Lena Dunham's newsletter. Mm. And I think Lena Dunham is a little controversial. She does some things that I think are really tone deaf and lame. And she also does some things that I think are really brave and awesome. We've talked about her before, haven't
we? I think Camille Paglia doesn't like her. I have.
Oh, really? Well, then that means I like her because I also like Gloria Steinem. So there.
I'd love to see the two of them actually in conversation.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But so The Lenny Letter, I would never like wholeheartedly recommend something like Girls, although I have a lot of thoughts about Girls and it could fill a whole podcast. But I think Girls is a really interesting show, and doing something in its own little very small bubble. But let's leave Girls aside. Lenny Letter is her newsletter that she does with her co-producer, co-everything, Jenny Connor. And she does some really cool stuff of elevating voices that you don't hear very often, and then of also having people who are really famous write about things that you don't read them writing about very often, which I think is really cool. And so it's a really cool mix of essays and fiction, and there's art sometimes, and there's interviews sometimes. Lena Dunham does not, like, it is not overly about her. She does not typically write for it. She'll sometimes write the introduction and sometimes not. But it's just, it's really cool, and it's something that I really look forward to getting in my inbox delivered as a newsletter. There was recently, and I thought of you recently, Frank, because there was an essay about Jane Jacobs.
Oh, yeah.
That was written by somebody who has just made a new documentary about her. And there was a book list that went with it. So there's a lot of like bookish literary stuff going on, and I really like it. So it's the Lenny Letter newsletter. You can just go
cool.
and sign up.
Well, you mentioned Jane Jacobs is a preservation and city planner and real pioneer in that field. And she lived in the Village, Greenwich Village, where the library work in Jefferson Market is. And I could totally end another podcast, talk about preservation because of the building
that
I work in.
Oh, that would be
saved.
Interesting.
It's
I would love to hear about that.
Interesting
story.
Okay, stories.
So on our next podcast, we're going to talk about preservation and girls.
No, we're not. On the next podcast, we're having an interview with
That's
Repeat
right.
and Let's Out.
Yes. Okay, next time we're going to have, look at you, we're going to have an interview with Corey from Storytime Underground. And Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Please go review us in iTunes if you feel so inclined. We would really love that.
Only positively. Good things on the internet.
You can also check out our show page at nypl.org/podcast and see a full rundown of our episodes. And you can find us on Twitter at NYPL Recommends. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you next week.